Hi, I'm Yusuf Zine. My latest TVO Today podcast is on how a Canadian ends up in a Chinese prison and if he's even alive. Listen and subscribe to Extradition. Available now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome, everyone, to the On Poly podcast. I'm Steve Paikin.
And I'm John Michael McGrath.
Today on the pod, the federal government released its budget this week, and there is much to discuss on the housing file. So we will do that.
Highway 413 has cleared a major hurdle as the feds and the province reach a deal.
Is the keffiyeh, the headscarf, which many in the Palestinian community wear, a political statement? The Speaker of the Legislature thinks it is, and he has banned it at Queen's Park.
Several MPPs were quietly removed from Queen's Park committee positions last week. Can you guess which party kicked which other party's members off of those committees? I bet you can.
In your column, my column, I'm focused on the possibility that Premier Doug Ford won't wait the full 4 years before Ontario holds its next general election. It's a theory. See what you think of it.
And I'll focus on one possible future for EVs in Ontario's power grid.
It's Friday, April 19th, 2024, so let's get to it. Okay, first of all, I have to say, much improved on the clothing front this week.
Back to the whimsical t-shirts.
Exactly. You're back to the whimsical t-shirts.
Space sharks.
Because space shark? What? What?
Because space sharks are their own reason. They sharks in space, man.
Okay. So you're back to the space theme and that's fine.
Yes. A lot of my whimsical t-shirts are space themed.
Whimsical. You like that word, don't you? Yeah. I'm going for a sort of old-fashioned TVO here. This is a two, as in studio two, as in a show I used to co-host here. Oh boy, when was it? 1994 to 2006. I think that's when I did it. Anyway, there we go. So that's our obligatory clothing references off the top, which we always seem to do.
And I guess I'll just say I'm getting a bit of a cold. So apologies to our audience if my voice sounds a bit off. I haven't been drinking bourbon and smoking cigarettes.
I was going to say it sounds lovely and deep. Keep that up. Keep it going. I would like to just throw in here a kind of a neat moment that happened at Queen's Park this past week. I can't swear that it's never happened before, but I'm really pretty darn sure it's never happened before. And I just start by saying every day at question period, MPPs are offered the opportunity to kind of introduce visitors who may be in the visitors gallery watching things. And on Monday of this week, one of the MPPs who's sitting in the legislature introduced his father, who was visiting. And here's how it looked and sounded.
Introduction to visitors. I recognize the member for Kitchener-Conestoga.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker, and it's not often that I get to do this, but I would like to welcome Paige Ryder-Harris's grandfather, my father, and the 22nd Premier of Ontario, Premier Mike Harris, to the legislature today.
Now, what's interesting there, first of all, everybody stood up. Even the New Democrats, Liberals, and Greens stood up. So that shows that all these years later, there is respect. I don't know, though, that it's ever happened before where a current MPP introduced a previous MPP who happened to be the premier of the province. I thought maybe it was possible that it happened in the Miller family, because after all, Frank Miller was the 19th premier of Ontario in 1985. His son, Norm Miller, represented the same riding many years later, I think 16 years later in 2001. And I thought, is it possible Norm at some point introduced Frank? So I texted Norm to find out, and he said, no, alas, never happened. His father died in 2000. Norm didn't get elected till 2001, so it never happened. So I think the Harrises are the one and only.
A few things have to go right for this kind of a situation to happen, and it's pretty rare. It's not unheard of, obviously, for a son to follow their father into politics. We've talked about like Dalton McGuinty as one example, mm-hmm. Where it has happened before, though, of course, in the case of Dalton McGuinty, he ran for his father's seat after his father's sudden death. It was a very unexpected thing. So that obviously wasn't, that was not going to happen with the McGuinty family in that context. You do wonder, though, like, as this goes on, the Province of Ontario is not going to stop existing, and at least not tomorrow. And so, will this be something that we see more frequently? Maybe not with the Harris family, but, we've already seen the current premier is the son of a former MPP. Politics is not just a family business, but it's also not a family business,
yes,
if you know what I mean.
Exactly right. We sure do. Okay. And with that, on to issue one. The federal government has tabled its budget, which they've been releasing piecemeal over the last several weeks. A big focus, though, is on housing. So let's talk about some of the highlights there. JMM, if you would, take us through it.
Right. So a lot of the elements of the housing policy parts of the budget had been announced previously. We have gotten very, very far from the old rule that you didn't talk about the budget until the very moment that the finance minister stood up in the House. Some of these items that had been announced, things like billions of dollars for housing. This includes money for building necessary infrastructure, water and wastewater infrastructure, building recreational facilities, money to address homelessness, and also, and I think this is important, money to enhance the collection of housing data, because we don't actually have a great handle on what is always happening in the housing sector. And I mean, just a classic example of this is, you know, we have spent years talking about the role of non-Canadian citizens investing in the housing market, people buying up Canadian properties who either do not live here or mostly do not live here. And I would challenge anybody to try to give an actual fact-based answer to the question of how often that's actually happening, because I will tell you that, like, I don't think StatsCan knows. So it's important to spend the money on the data collection. But there's also a lot more in here.
Well, as you might imagine, some folks at Queen's Park weren't as thrilled with the news as they could have been. So let's see what the Ontario Minister of Municipal Affairs and Housing, Paul Calandra, had to say about that.
What we saw in yesterday's federal budget is a government whose spending is out of control, not focused on what matters to the people of the province of Ontario, which is affordability, giving them the opportunity to buy homes and giving the people who build the homes the opportunity to build those homes.
I'm not sure that's the reaction Chrystia Freeland was looking for.
No, the Ontario government continues to rail against the federal carbon tax. They are not aggressively building a bridge with the federal government here.
That's a nice way to put it. Well, Ontario's big city mayors, which are an advocacy group, as you might imagine, for the biggest cities in this province, they actually did applaud the budget in their feedback. And let's have a look at that. Sheldon, we'll bring this graphic up if you would. We ask that they address the concerns of the municipal sector on the proposed freeze of municipal development charges in some of our municipalities. Development charges help to pay for critical housing, supportive infrastructure, and community amenities. And without them, these costs will be added to the existing property tax base. Okay, let's dig into that more.
Right. So this is becoming a real sharp point of division between the federal and provincial government. The federal minister of housing, Sean Fraser, has really highlighted the fact that the provincial government in its recent housing bill has allowed development charges to increase more quickly. We mentioned on last week's episode that this issue of development charges, as they are allowed to increase more quickly, the fear from the federal perspective and also from the industry's perspective is that those charges are going to functionally be just added to the sticker price of new houses when they are purchased. The federal government has made $6 billion on offer in the Canada Housing Infrastructure Fund that they are basically making conditional on municipalities freezing their development charges. From the federal perspective, of course, this is like, not even asking you to cut existing development charges, just don't increase them further. And here's some federal money to make up for what you would have gotten otherwise. And to be maybe somewhat discharitable, the position of a lot of cities is, well, we want the federal money, yes, but we also want to keep increasing development charges.
Yeah.
So you can see how this is a real sticking point, and it's going to be a point of disagreement between not just cities, but also the provincial government. There is also one other point I want to highlight from the budget, a bit of a weedsy item, but I think it's, that's our brand here. The federal government is changing the tax treatment of rental housing. If you know about sort of housing policy in Canada, we used to build a lot of rental housing in the 1960s and 1970s, and then we basically stopped. And one of the reasons that we stopped is that we changed the tax treatment of rental housing. And in particular, one of the things we did was change what's called the capital cost allowance, which I'm not going to get into the weeds of. It's just that—
Thank you.
It makes investing in rental housing less profitable, less attractive for investors than it would otherwise be. the federal government is going to somewhat reverse really a decades-long policy, and they are going to make they are going to allow a higher capital cost allowance, and that will hopefully make rental housing a much more attractive investment proposition. It doesn't go all the way to what we had in terms of the really generous tax treatment that we had in the 1970s, but it gets us part of the way there. And I think if you talk to people who work in the rental sector, they're very excited about these kinds of treatments. Because, of course, this isn't just the first change in tax policy. We also had the HST exemption for rental policies last year. So there have been a bunch of really pro-rental changes in both the provincial and federal tax treatment in the last year or so that I think a lot of people are excited about.
I think you buried the lead. I think the lead is that you are not perfect. And I always thought you were perfect. In fact, I tell everybody that I know, John Michael McGrath, I enjoy co-hosting with him because he is perfect. And then we discovered this past week, you're not?
I goofed. There is a correction that we need to make. We were discussing Bill 185, the new provincial housing bill. So this is not a provincial, or sorry, this is not a federal budget measure, but we were discussing Bill 185, and I said it reversed a policy that the government had made previously that refunded development charges in some circumstances. That was incorrect. I regret the error. The actual policy that was reversed was that the province had made it so that municipalities had to refund application fees. So this is just like the fee you pay to get your paperwork processed, not the development charges. And that was set to a shot clock, if you like, a timeline where if the municipality did not make a decision, either a yes or a no, just had not made a decision within a certain time frame, they had to refund the application fees. We could go into the details on that, but the short version is that the policy did not work the way that the province was hoping. You had a lot of cases where municipalities were simply refusing applications because they were running out of time and they didn't want to issue the refunds. So the province is more or less giving up on that policy. I would say that I think I described it in last week's episode as a win for municipalities. And I think while I got the development charge slash application fee issue wrong, directionally, at least, it was a win for municipalities in that sense.
Did I just hear you say shot clock?
I am trying to meet you halfway here. I'm working in the occasional sports metaphor.
I'm deeply impressed. You know what? As far as I'm concerned, all is forgiven. You may have made a tiny error last week, but the fact that you're using sports references now is deeply impressive to me.
I think maybe our employer would prefer that I get the journalistic facts right, even if I don't use quite so many sports metaphors.
I don't think so. No, I'm going with the sports metaphors. I think that's better. So, okay, back to the federal budget. Overall, it's a budget. It's a budget with a big focus on housing. Yes, they are going to tax, what was it? The even, it's not even 1%, I think, isn't it?
Or it's, maybe like 1/10 of 1%.
It's a very small percentage of the Canadian public who will be taxed more.
Yes.
In order to keep the fiscal guardrails in place and make sure the deficit doesn't go beyond $40 billion this fiscal year. So there's a lot going on here. You want to give us an overall takeaway?
Right. So, I mean, you're referring to the increase in the inclusion rate of the capital gains tax. If people aren't familiar with what capital gains taxation looks like in Canada, currently income from capital gains is functionally only half of that is subject to taxation. The federal budget proposes to increase that in some cases to 2/3.
It's when you sell a farm or you sell a home or something like that.
Yeah, or stocks.
Stocks.
Any kind of financial asset. The reaction among certain people in the finance sector, some people in the tech sector, very angry about this. They, feel like it's going to make the country a more difficult place to attract investment. And Canada's tech sector already arguably doesn't have the easiest time attracting investment compared to like Silicon Valley. To take it to the political, I'm not an economist, nor am I a tax accountant. But the political side of this feels very familiar to me. The 2018 Ontario budget, the spring of that year when it was still the Wynne government, right before the last election.
Yeah, their last budget.
Their last budget. And you may recall that they went back into deficit, but there were also some tax measures that they increased the taxation of people in high income brackets. They fiddled with tax brackets, and the effect was to increase the taxes paid by very high income earners. And, you know, at the risk of being, you know, the kind of person who only ever learned one thing, this just feels very familiar. The government is getting, I would say, you're seeing a lot of aggressive, progressive policies coming out of the federal government right now. And at the same time, they are trying to find ways to fund it all. But whistling past the graveyard is not quite the phrase I'm looking for here, but all of this feels like it's not going to survive the next election. We'll be talking about the next federal and potentially provincial election in a bit, but this just seems like a measure that it's going to last 18 months, maybe.
Well, as they say, you never know. And that's why they have elections.
It's true.
Yeah. And with that, on to issue two. The Ontario government experienced a big win this week when it announced it had reached a deal with the federal government to build the 413 highway across the top of the Greater Toronto Area. As you know, the Ford government has been very anxious to build this highway. The feds have been trying to slow things down, citing environmental concerns in areas that fall under its jurisdiction. And somehow, JMM, they seem to have figured out a compromise here.
Two crazy kids. They finally made it work. The federal government has agreed to drop its requirement for a full federal impact assessment. Instead, both levels of the government will have a working group to find ways to minimize the highway's environmental impact in areas that fall under federal jurisdiction.
So I guess the key question now is, given that there is this agreement between the two levels of government with skin in the game, is it 100% a go?
Queen's Park certainly believes it is. But I think, you know, we could say not necessarily, or at least not so fast. Let's just say I don't expect this highway to be complete before the next provincial election.
No, it sure won't be.
So, you know, this is a province where it is always possible to cancel infrastructure projects after an election. There are still going to be some federal permissions that are required, but it's probably going to be much more constrained, and we'll talk about that in a second. But the government does say they want shovels in the ground by next year, by 2025. So it's certainly the best it has looked for Highway 413 in more than a year.
I'm trying to figure out how this happened, though, because the feds have been unequivocal, and particularly this current Minister of the Environment federally, unequivocal in their opposition to spending $10 billion to create a new highway that they believe won't alleviate traffic at all. Like, won't save any, by the time it's up and rolling, which is 10 years from now, won't save any time at all. So I guess I want to know, why did the feds give in?
Well, I think part of the answer here is that the federal government did effectively lose a court case at the Supreme Court of Canada last year. Quick refresher for our audience. The Alberta government had challenged the constitutionality of the Impact Assessment Act. This is the federal law we're talking about that had held up Highway 413. Ontario joined the constitutional challenge to the Impact Assessment Act at the Supreme Court level, and in their arguments specifically cited Highway 413 as an example of federal overreach, of the federal government intruding on a core area of provincial jurisdiction, right? There was, as far as I can tell, there had never been a previous example of the federal government using its environmental jurisdiction to try to interfere in any way with provincial highway planning. The Supreme Court decided that, in fact, the Impact Assessment Act was, or at least this part of the Impact Assessment Act that we're talking about, was outside of federal jurisdiction, and the power to designate projects was so broadly written and was so disconnected from the core parts of federal jurisdiction that it had to be struck down. Or I say struck down, but when you're talking about reference cases, technically speaking, the law was not struck down. The court simply said, this is unconstitutional. And then the federal government responded by saying, we will bring new legislation forward that will comply with the Supreme Court's decision. We do expect to see that law at some point this year. But in the meantime, I think that explains the more conciliatory tone coming from Ottawa.
So the courts, in effect, cut the feds off at the knees on this one.
Yeah, I think they are sort of conceding the point that they do not have the power to stop Highway 413. Whatever they bring forward as a future law for federal impact assessment, and let's be clear, there are tons of areas where the federal government will retain jurisdiction, migratory birds, fisheries. One issue that's going to be really important for the province going forward is that a nuclear power is federal jurisdiction. So these are all areas where some future impact assessment law is going to be important for provincial projects no matter what. But it's very difficult for me to imagine what future law, how they could write it that it would comply with the Supreme Court's decision and also threaten provincial highway planning in any way.
I would just make one caveat to those who really still oppose this highway being built, and there are plenty of people, although let's say for the record, the Conservatives won all of the seats along the route of this proposed highway during the last 2022 provincial election. Having said that, if you go back 50 years, there was something in the city of Toronto called the Spadina Expressway that was as done a deal as they come. Metropolitan Toronto Council was in favor of it. The provincial government was in favor of it, or so it seemed. And then the protest started and continued. And Bill Davis, one of the first things he did after he became premier in 1971, got up in the legislature and said, "Mr. Speaker, if we want to build cities for cars, the Spadina Expressway is a great place to start. But if we want to build cities for people, then the Spadina Expressway is a great place to stop." And he stopped it.
Great line. One of my favorite lines.
Dalton Camp wrote it. Yeah, it was a great line. Anyway, so as Yogi Berra, the great political scientist, once said, it ain't over till it's over. So it ain't over yet.
Not yet.
Particularly if there's a change of government in a future election, given that this thing's going to take 10 years to build, you never know. The same thing could happen. So anyway, I put that out there for what it's worth.
Absolutely. And with that, on to issue three.
Last week, we learned that six MPPs were being removed from a range of committees at Queen's Park. I know this sounds inside baseball, but stick with us. There's a principle here. The MPPs include Stephen Blais, Stephanie Bowman, Adil Shamji, Bobby Ann Brady, Ashlyn Clancy, Mike Schreiner, and John Fraser. Do you know what these all have in common?
Not one of them is a Tory or a New Democrat.
You are correct, sir. Yes, they are Liberals, they are Greens, they are Independents. The Liberal parliamentary leader, John Fraser, responded to this development by saying, "The removal of six Liberal, Green, and Independent MPPs without notice is just another example of this government attempting to silence their critics. They don't like tough questions or to be held accountable. So I guess the question is, what gives here?"
So the rules of the legislature are that committee seats are allocated, or at least should be allocated, roughly based on the size of the caucus in the House itself. So not surprisingly, the government gets the majority of seats in the committees, with a few exceptions, because they have a majority in the House, and a large majority. But that leaves relatively few seats in the committees to divide up between the independents and the NDP. And I'll just remind our listeners that for the purposes we're talking about here, Liberal and Green MPPs are counted as independents because they are not recognized parties. So the government says that they are just rejigging the committee makeup to more fairly represent the makeup of the House.
Okay, so we understand why the government might want fewer opposition voices from other parties involved in the committees. But the official opposition, the NDP, went along with this as well. Is there some sense that they colluded with the government on this? Because frankly, they don't want to give the Liberals or Greens any more ice time either.
No, that's true. The government's explanation actually is that the independents were overrepresented numerically and that this allows the NDP to be more fairly represented on committees reflecting their standing in the House. Now, I can't say whether the NDP actually sought this outcome. I kind of suspect that they may have been as surprised by this as anybody, but I certainly don't imagine that they objected.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
If the government was trying to be truly nefarious here, though, one of the indicators here is that Hamilton Centre MPP Sarah Jama still has a committee seat, and she is not favored by the current government at all.
She's an independent, right?
She is an independent, and yet she retains a committee seat. So I kind of suspect that this is not while there may be shenanigans going on here, it's not the crassest kind, if I can put it that way.
Okay, listen, while we're on the subject of sort of the internal deliberations at Queen's Park, there was a really fascinating and I think unprecedented and, well, let's just say this story has captured this week a great deal of public attention because it has to do with what you're allowed to wear if you are inside the Legislative Assembly of Ontario. There is a tradition that whatever you do wear, it can't make a political statement. And the Speaker of the Legislature, Ted Arnott, who has jurisdiction over Queen's Park, what he says goes here, he determined that the wearing of a keffiyeh, a headscarf that has been favored for centuries in much of the Palestinian community, the Arab world, the Middle East, and so on, that at this moment in our collective history, in the view of the Speaker, it is too much of a political statement to wear a keffiyeh, and therefore he banned it. Now, interestingly enough, the Speaker has managed to unite all four party leaders represented in the legislature, Tory, Liberal, New Democrat, and Green, all of whose leaders came out and said, Mr. Speaker, we think you've made the wrong decision and we would like you to reverse yourself. Here was Doug Ford in Oakville at a press conference yesterday. Sheldon, roll it.
Well, the keffiyeh goes back to the 7th century, but it really comes down to uniting Ontarians and communities. We see the division right now that's going on. It's not healthy, and this would just divide the community even more. So I stand by that, and we'll bring it to the legislature.
So, you know, we'll just say to our listeners, you know, cultural dresses have never been barred at Queen's Park, or there have been exceptions made to the sort of general rules very frequently. And I think of Jagmeet Singh when he was an MPP. I think they had to change the rules not for his headscarf, but for his kirpan, the knife that
ceremonial dagger.
Yes, that Sikhs wear, and that has generally been allowed. And but the key issue here really is the Speaker's interpretation of this rule against political statements. And obviously with what's going on in the Middle East right now, he believed that, and said it on Thursday morning, he did his research and he believes that the wearing of a keffiyeh is a political statement about the war in Gaza right now. And we're both scratching our head here trying to think of an occasion where the Speaker has been rebuked by the leaders of parties representing almost all of the
all
MPPs.
Four. Yeah, yeah. Well, okay, let's acknowledge a couple of things right now. Number one, honorable people can disagree on this issue, right? I mean, there is an interpretation which says it's a political statement and therefore should be banned. There's another interpretation that says it's a cultural affectation and therefore there shouldn't be any difficulty with it at all. There are certainly people in the Jewish community and others right now who think to wear that, particularly in the seat of government, is to make a very strong political statement given events in the Middle East. There are others who obviously disagree. Now, let's fess up here. We are not, if you're watching this on TVO Friday night at 8 o'clock, we are not live right now. We are recording this earlier. And as a result, we may not be exactly up to the minute here on what's going on. But one development on Thursday morning that did take place that was quite fascinating was that it looked like a little work had been done behind the scenes between the Speaker and the parties, because Marit Stiles, the opposition leader, got up and said, we disagree. All the party leaders disagree, Mr. Speaker, with your ruling, and therefore we think you should change your mind. And the Speaker got up and said, okay, I'm your servant. If you all agree I should change my mind, I will do so, but I need unanimous consent from this House to do so.
Yeah.
What happened next?
And I just want to specify, you know, unanimous consent here is a procedural trick that we use at Queen's Park very frequently, because there's the rules, and the rules say what they say, and the Speaker has made his interpretation of the rules, but then you always have it's kind of this cheat code to get around the rules or to modify the rules with the unanimous consent of the House. And so Marit Stiles asked for unanimous consent, and the Speaker, the Speaker very clearly expected that unanimous consent motion to come. He put it to the House, and then we heard a chorus of voices, a lot of yeses, and then at least one no. And that's it. Like, that means it's not unanimous.
I only heard one female voice say no.
Yes. And from what we've been able to monitor, I believe it came from the government side of the House.
Sounded like it.
The House will not reconsider this again on Thursday. They don't sit on Friday. So this is going to go at least into next week. Hmm. They might try to get unanimous consent again on Monday or Tuesday. But the thing about, you know, there's a principle of like the individual right of the member. And perhaps somebody's going to get the Riot Act read to them over the weekend and will be gently or not gently encouraged to change their mind, or at least just to not show up for work that day. But if somebody wants to keep showing up at the House and saying no to a unanimous consent motion, they are within their rights to do that.
Now, having said all this, I think I was just told in my earpiece that the Toronto Star is reporting that it was Eglinton Lawrence MPP Robin Martin, who was one of the MPPs who said no. And I think we can speculate as to why.
Right. I mean, she represents a community with a lot of Jewish voters in it. And, you know, we already discussed that, you know, people have a very different interpretation of what the kafia means, depending on where you sit in the politics of the Middle East.
There you go. And with that, let's talk about last week's columns. Time now for our regular feature. It's called Your Column, My Column, in which JMM and I chat about the columns that we wrote for the TVO website, tvo.org, over the past week. Which one of yours are you going to favor us with today?
I'm
going to
go nerdy, not surprisingly, perhaps. we've talked a lot about electric vehicles in Ontario, about the jobs we want to have here from building them, but and the potential stress that they could put on the power grid, because, of course, electric vehicles need electricity to run. And if we start replacing millions of cars on the road with electric vehicles, we need to build the power plants and the wires to deliver all that electricity. One thing that I don't think is talked about as much is this idea that electric cars could also feed power back onto the grid at times when it is most needed. So the sort of classic example of this idea that has been floating around for a while is that you might charge up a car overnight when here in Ontario, we tend to have lots of surplus power sloshing around. And then during a summer heat wave, when everybody turns their air conditioners on at noon, the cars could feed that electricity back into the power system. And if we had enough people doing that, it might obviate the need for things like natural gas plants, which we currently tend to use a lot of for that summer peak period. You know, environmentalists, big fan of this idea, but there's a lot of questions that need to be worked out, right? Do car owners want to let the government or the utility, however you want to think of it, do they want to let the utility have a chunk of their battery life every day? You know, obviously it would be a voluntary system, but you probably end up needing to pay people to incentivize them.
I wondered if you're going to, if we're going to give you our power, do we get paid for that?
Well, and so like, not only are you going to pay people for their electricity, but also this is wear and tear on people's batteries, right? It's going to shorten the lifespan of their car. So you probably have to pay them for that too. I spoke with somebody at the IESO, which is one of the provincial agencies that does power planning here.
Independent Electricity System Operator.
Yes. And, you know, one thing they said is that, you know, it might not have to be a lot of money if they can make it easy enough. And they've had some recent success in getting people who already have smart thermostats in their home to sign up to a provincial program that turns down people's thermostats when it's when the system is in highest demand. So they're optimistic in that sense, but this is all still very, very early days because, of course, EVs are not a huge part of the car market yet. But, you know, everybody's trying to see which way the ball is going and aim for that.
Two things. Number one, I read all your columns, but I really liked this one. Okay. I found this one particularly fascinating. And number two, so clearly did you, because you are talking about it with such great enthusiasm here right now. I can tell that you're very jazzed by this issue. And not only that, that the notion that if we can figure out how to make this work and we don't have to burn some natural gas as a result of having this newfound power, it'll clean up the environment, which is a beautiful thing.
Well, and I think, you know, the scale that we're talking about is really important to put in people's minds, right? Like, cars take a lot of energy. Making a big, heavy thing go fast takes a lot of energy. And so even a totally sort of normal, even a modest mid-sized car carries enough electricity to run your average Ontario household for 3 or 4 days. And so, you know, even using a small amount of the battery capacity that a person is driving around every day anyway, using maybe 10% of their battery, you could do a lot if we've got 9 or 10 million cars on the road by 2040.
Which we will.
Yes.
Fabulous.
And how about you, Steve?
Okay, I am going to do a little Q&A with you to suss out what my column was about. Are you ready to go?
I'm ready to go.
Okay. How often do we have elections in the province of Ontario?
When there's a majority government, we have an election every 4 years.
Correct. How do we know that the next election will be, in fact, on June 4th, 2026?
Because current law says so, and it's said roughly that for about 20 years, we've had a fixed election law in place.
Right. Fixed election date tells us when the election will be. What if the premier of the day, for whatever reason, decided he didn't want to wait the full 4 years before having the next election? Could he call an election earlier?
Yes, he could.
Right again. We have the fixed election date law, but there is a loophole in that law which says, yes, a majority government is allowed to live for 4 years, and then the premier doesn't really call the election. We know when the election's happening. But there's a little out clause in the law that says, if we want to go earlier, we actually can, or later for that matter. And I guess I asked the question in my column, is that something that Doug Ford and his top advisors are considering right now? Namely, that they want to go sooner than June 2026. And my answer to the question was, and I'm just speculating here, my answer is, yeah, I bet he does. And here's why. Okay, JMM, you're back on it. When's the next federal election?
Under current law, it would be October 2025, though the federal minority parliament at the moment adds some ambiguity to that.
It does indeed. But based on the polling that we have seen over the past year, what is everybody's expectation for the outcome of that next federal election?
If the current polling holds, everybody expects a conservative majority.
When conservatives are in power in Ottawa, what pretty much happens all the time at Queen's Park, at least for, you know, the last six decades?
Ontario voters tend to put a different party in power at Queen's Park.
Correct again. So if Pierre Poilievre wins the next federal election, and again, it's an if right now, we don't know, it likely changes based on history. It changes the dynamic at Queen's Park because Ontarians have this habit of ticket splitting. And I'll go through it with you here. And let's go back 60 years. You had the Tory John Robarts at Queen's Park. You had the Liberals Lester Pearson and Pierre Trudeau in Ottawa. After that, Tory Bill Davis at Queen's Park, Liberal Pierre Trudeau in Ottawa. After that, Tory Brian Mulroney in Ottawa, the Liberals David Peterson and the NDP's Bob Rae at Queen's Park. Keep going. Liberal Jean Chrétien in Ottawa, Tory Mike Harris at Queen's Park, Tory Stephen Harper in Ottawa, the Liberals Dalton McGuinty and Kathleen Wynne at Queen's Park, Liberal Justin Trudeau in Ottawa, Tory Doug Ford at Queen's Park. Happens almost all the time. So, would Doug Ford call an early election, potentially for next spring, 3 years into a four-year term, to attempt to renew his majority government mandate before Pierre Poilievre has an opportunity to beat Justin Trudeau? And my answer is maybe. And not only that, what other big thing is coming down the pike here that, you know, everybody will be paying attention to at some point in 2026?
You're referring to the RCMP investigation?
Correct. Yep. I didn't even need to give you the hint. I was going to say think Greenbelt, but you were already there. Yeah. Maybe you'd like to go back to the polls before the RCMP drops an enormous stink bomb in your lap, which could be, we don't know, but could be, you know, criminal charges just before a 2026 election campaign. I suspect yes. Anyway.
And for clarity, like, it doesn't need to be criminal charges laid on Doug Ford or one of his ministers. It could be charges for staffers. And we've seen, even in cases where it's, you know, someone a degree or two away from the premier, it just causes this enormous political headache.
Absolutely. So I wrote a column about this, obviously, and we invite you to go to our website, tvo.org, and look at the columns. I've had enough feedback from enough people in high-ish places on this one who've said, Pakin, keep an eye out. You're not totally wrong on this to make me think that there's something here. So we will continue to watch with interest.
All right. And with that, let's go to the mailbag.
If you've got a burning question or insightful comment, please send it along to us at onpolitics@tvo.org. JMM, start us off.
Okay. Here is an email from listener Tony Lavella from Welland, who writes, Ahoy team, I am a newer listener who found the podcast after searching for more books like Steve's Pakin and the Premiers. You are doing the informed populace a great service. Could you recommend any books about Ontario's politics, elections, or even the general course of Ontario's provincial history? I feel we need to know more about how we got to where we are now by examining where we were and who brought us here. Kind thanks, Tony.
Tony, I love this question.
Yes.
Thank you very much. All right, some suggestions in no particular order. If you want something on the end of the 42-year-long Tory dynasty, which of course was an election of historic proportions. That one was in 1985. I'd recommend Out of the Blue by Rosemary Spears. Really good book summing up the dynasty, how it lasted, and how it ended, more particularly in 1985. If you want something on what many thought was an equally historic election in 1990, this is the NDP's only victory to date, where Bob Rae became the premier, there's a book called Not Without Cause by Georgette Gagnon and Dan Rath. They were two Liberal staffers who wrote a very tough book about why the Liberals were thrown out in 1990. Let's keep going. If you want something on the Tories coming back to power in 1995, I'm happy to recommend a book called Promised Land, Inside the Mike Harris Revolution. That's by the Globe and Mail's John Ibbotson. That was an historic election because it was the first time in more than 70 years where the third place party jumped all the way up to first place and government in one election. And John Ibbotson is all over that one. And Tony, if you want to ask yourself, I wonder if Pakin is too modest to recommend a couple of his own books, the answer is definitely not. So I wrote a couple of books about a couple of premiers. John Robarts was the first premier I wrote about, and the book I wrote was called Public Triumph, Private Tragedy, The Double Life of John P. Robarts. And it was a double life because, on the one hand, he had a rather magnificent premiership. The 1960s were absolutely the best time to be the government of Ontario. The money was coming into the coffers. They were building schools. They were building universities. They built this place. They built TVO as well. His education minister, Bill Davis, very responsible for all of that. However, he had this god-awful, tragic private life in which he, Mr. Robarts, was lost to suicide after his political career was over. His son was lost to suicide. His first wife drank herself to death. And his daughter died of cancer in her 50s. So the whole family was wiped out under tragic circumstances. So the Robarts book is a very, very dramatic story. It's Shakespearean in its both great triumphs and awful tragedies. And the last book I'm going to recommend, frankly, is something that if you need a doorstop, it's perfect for that too. It's about that thick. It's called Bill Davis, Nation Builder, and Not So Bland After All. Bill Davis was the longest serving premier of Ontario in the 20th century. He used to joke when somebody asked him, why do you run such a boring, bland government? He used to say, bland works. And it did for him. He won four straight elections. No one's done that in 100 years. We are in the Bill Davis studio right now here at TVO, named after him, obviously. And he was, a premier of huge transformational significance in the province of Ontario. So I did a book on him, too. There you go. Five books for your edification and consideration.
I will throw one more on the list. I actually don't read a ton of Ontario history in like book form. If I'm like researching something, I tend to go first to like journal articles, that kind of thing. It's a habit I picked up from university. But there is a book about Toronto history that I really like to recommend to people. And it is called The Revenge of the Methodist Bicycle Company. And it is all about...
Is that the real title?
Yes, that is the real title. It is all about the introduction of the first streetcar lines to Toronto. And if you want to understand some of the culture of the city, I frankly, I think in ways that still shape it today, this is a really important book. So like, why does the topic of streetcar service in Toronto in the 1880s deserve a book? Well, one of the political controversies of the day was whether the streetcar lines would be allowed to run on Sundays, because the high fathers of the church were scandalized by the idea that people, and particularly the working class, would be able to take a streetcar to the beach or some nice part of the city instead of going to church like they properly should. Now, of course, this is also like, Toronto in that day, you know, people were going straight from the church services to the bars. So it's not like everybody was purely engaged in sober prayer. But nevertheless, the church fathers were, as I say, scandalized by the idea of Sunday streetcar service. And then just to add another sort of transportation technology layer to the whole thing, the first sort of financial crisis for these privately run streetcar services, we talked a bit about this last week, the first big crisis that they faced was not the introduction of the automobile. It was not, suburban sprawl after World War II. It was the introduction of the bicycle. This is where we get the title from. And once people could buy a cheap mass-produced bicycle in the late 1800s and they no longer had to rely on the streetcar services, that was when they first saw this big drop off in passenger service, and that's a whole other story. But yeah, the book is very wide ranging. It's not just about all of these things that I talked about, and it's very, very good at giving you a sense of, let's say, some of the oddities of Toronto in the late 1800s.
You know what? I'm going to play the age card again here. Yes. You young whippersnappers don't remember, but I do, and your dad would as well. There was a time in the capital city of the province of Ontario where, never mind, you couldn't buy a newspaper on a Sunday because no one published on Sunday, but if you went to your local park, they would take the swings and they would chain them up so that you could not push your kid on a swing. That was how much they expected you not to be out having fun, but to be in church on Sunday doing the Lord's work.
Well, and I mean, into what, the 1990s, or the early 2000s, there was still a part of the city where they did not allow bars to operate.
That's this right, like in the West End.
They had inherited this Prohibition-era licensing law.
Quite true.
Some of these factors live with us still.
Why don't you give the email address before we head out?
Right. What is the email? It is onpolitics@tvo.org. Please, if you've got any questions about content on this show, send us an email and give us your name and where you're from.
We do love them. So thank you very much. And that is the On Poly podcast for this April 19th, 2024.
You can follow our show on Apple Podcasts so you get notified each time a new episode is available. And you can see the video version of the podcast on the TVO Today YouTube channel.
Any feedback you have, we're happy to hear it, good, bad, or indifferent. Write us an email at onpolitics@tvo.org and be sure to include your first and last name and where you're located.
This week's episode was produced and edited by Matthew O'Mara, video editing by Colin Kish.
Production support from Jonathan Hallowell, Christine Gardner, Carla Lucchetta, and Vito Tagarelli.
Our managing editor is Katie O'Connor. Lori Few is the executive producer of digital. John Ferry is vice president, programming and content.
Special thanks, as we always like to do, to our wonderful studio crew for keeping this podcast looking so sharp. And so until next Friday, everybody, bye-bye.
Bye-bye, everyone.